Welcome to Stories from the Shadows. Haunted tales from the golden age of ghost stories and supernatural fiction. I'm Martin, and this week's story is The Sumach by Ulrich Daubigny. How red that sumach is. Irene Barton murmured something commonplace, for to her the tree brought painful recollections. Her visitor, unconscious of this fact, proceeded to elaborate. Do you know, Irene, that tree gives me the creeps. I can't explain, except that it is not a nice tree. It's not a good tree. For instance, why should its leaves be red in August, when they are not supposed to turn until October? What queer ideas you have, May. The tree is right enough, although its significance to me is sad. Poor Spot, you know, we buried him beneath it 2 days ago. Come and see his grave. The two women left the terrace, where this conversation had been taking place, and leisurely strolled across the lawn, at the end of which an almost startling isolation grew the sumach. At least, Mrs. Whatcombe, who invents so great an interest in the tree, questioned whether it actually was a sumach, for the foliage was unusual, and the branches gnarled and twisted beyond recognition. Just now the leaves were stained with splashes of dull crimson, but rather than droop they had a bloated appearance, as if the luxuriance of the growth were not altogether healthy. For several moments they stood regarding the pathetic little grave, and the silence was only broken when Mrs. Whatcombe darted beneath the tree and came back with something in her hand. Irene, look at this dead thrush. Poor little thing. Such splendid plumage. Yet it hardly weighs a sugar plum. Mrs. Barton regarded it with wrinkled brows. I cannot understand what happens to the birds, May. Unless someone lays poison, we continually find them dead about the garden, and usually beneath or very near this tree. It is doubtful whether Mrs. Whatcombe listened. Her attention seemed to wander that morning, and she was studying the twisted branches of the sumach with a thoughtful scrutiny. Curious that the leaves should turn at this time of year, she murmured. It brings to mind poor Geraldine's illness. This tree had an extraordinary fascination for her, you know. It was quite scarlet then, yet that was only June, and it had barely finished shooting. My dear May, you have red leaves on the brain this morning, Irene retorted, uncertain whether to be irritated or amused. I can't think why you were so concerned about the color. It is only the result of 2 days' excessive heat, for scarcely a leaf was touched when I buried poor old Spot. The conversation seemed absurdly trivial. Yet, Mrs. Whatcombe gone, Irene could not keep her mind from dwelling on her cousin's fatal illness. The news had reached them with the shock of the absolutely unexpected. Poor Geraldine, who had always been so strong, to have fallen victim to acute anemia. It was almost unbelievable that heart failure should have put an end to her sweet young life after a few days ailing. Of course, the sad event had wrought a wonderful change for Irene and her husband, giving them, in place of a cramped suburban villa, this beautiful country home, Cleeve Grange. Everything for her was filled with the delight of novelty, for she had ruled as mistress over the charmed abode for only one short week. Hilary, her husband, was yet a stranger to the more intimate of its attractions, being detained in London by the winding up of business affairs. Several days elapsed, for the most part given solely to the keen pleasure of arranging and rearranging the new home. As time went by, the crimson splashes on the sumac faded, the leaves becoming green again, though drooping as if from want of moisture. Irene noticed this when she paid her daily visits to the pathetic little dog grave, trying to induce flowers to take root upon it. But do what she might, they invariably faded. Nothing, not even grass, would grow beneath the sumac. Only death seemed to thrive there, she mused, in a fleeting moment of depression, as she searched around for more dead birds. But none had fallen since the thrush, picked up by Mrs. Whatcom. One evening, the heat inside the house becoming insupportable, Irene wandered into the garden, her steps mechanically leading her to the little grave beneath the sumac. In the uncertain moonlight, the twisted trunk and branches of the old tree were suggestive of a rustic seat, and feeling tired, she lifted herself into the natural bower and lolled back, joyously inhaling the cool night air. Presently she dropped asleep, and in a curiously vivid manner dreamt of Hilary, that he had completed his business in London and was coming home. They met at evening near the garden gate, and Hilary spread wide his arms and eagerly folded them about her. Swiftly the dream began to change, assuming the characteristic of a nightmare. The sky grew strangely dark, the arms fiercely masterful, while the face which bent to kiss her neck was not that of her young husband. It was a leering, wicked, gnarled face like the trunk of some weather-beaten tree. Chilled with horror, Irene fought long and desperately against the vision, to be at last awakened by her own frightened whimpering. Yet returning consciousness did not immediately dissipate the nightmare. In imagination, she was still held rigid by brutal arms, and it was only after a blind, half-waking struggle that she freed herself and went speeding across the lawn towards the lighted doorway. Next morning, Mrs. Whatcom called and subjected her to a puzzled scrutiny. "How pale you look, Irene. Do you feel ill?"
"Ill? No. Only a little languid. I find this hot weather very trying."
Mrs. Whatcom studied her with care, for the pallor of Irene's face was very marked. In contrast, a vivid spot of red showed on the slender neck, an inch or so below the ear. Intuitively, a hand went up as Irene turned to her friend in explanation.
"It feels so sore. I think I must have grazed the skin last night while sitting in the sumac."
"Sitting in the sumac?" echoed Mrs. Whatcom in surprise. "How curious. You should do that. Poor Geraldine used to do the same just before she was taken ill. And yet at the last she was seized with a perfect horror of the tree. Goodness, but it is quite red again this morning." Irene swung round in the direction of the tree, filled with a vague repugnance. Sure enough, the leaves no longer drooped, nor were they green. They had become flecked once more with crimson, and the growth had quite regained its former vigor.
"Ugh," she breathed, hurriedly turning towards the house. "It reminds me of a horrid nightmare. I have rather a head this morning. Let's go in and talk of something else."
As the day advanced, the heat grew more oppressive, and night brought with it a curious stillness. The stillness which so often presages a heavy thunderstorm. No bird had offered up its evening hymn. No breeze came sufficient to stir a single leaf. Everything was pervaded by the silence of expectancy. The interval between dinner and bedtime is always a dreary one for those accustomed to companionship. And left all alone, Irene's restlessness momentarily increased. First the ceiling, then the very atmosphere seemed to weigh heavy upon her head. Although windows and doors were all flung wide, the airlessness of the house grew less and less endurable, until from sheer desperation she made her escape into the garden, where a sudden illumination of the horizon gave warning of the approaching storm. Feeling somewhat at a loss, she roamed aimlessly a while, pausing sometimes to catch the echoes of distant thunder, until at last she found herself standing over Spot's desolate little grave. The sight struck her with a sense of utter loneliness, and the tears sprang to her eyes in poignant longing for the companionship of her faithful pet. Moved by she knew not what, Irene swung herself into the comfortable branches of the old sumac, and soothed by the reposeful attitude, her head soon began to nod in slumber. Afterwards it was a doubtful memory whether she did actually sleep, or whether the whole experience was not a kind of waking nightmare. Something of the previous evening's dream returned to her, but this time with added horror, for it commenced with no pleasurable vision of her husband. Instead, relentless stick-like arms immediately closed in upon her, their vice-like grip so tight that she could scarcely breathe. Down darted the awful head, rugged and lined by every sin, darting at the fair white neck as a wild beast on its prey. The foul lips began to eat into her skin. She struggled desperately, madly, for to her swooning senses, the very branches of the tree became endowed with active life, coiling unmercifully around her, tenaciously clinging to her limbs and tearing at her dress. Pain at last spurred her to an heroic effort. The pain of something, perhaps a twig, digging deep into her unprotected neck. With a choking cry, she freed herself and, nerved by a sudden burst of thunder, ran tottering towards the shelter of the house. Having gained the cozy lounge hall, Irene sank into an armchair, gasping hysterically for breath. Gusts of refreshing wind came through the open windows, but although the atmosphere rapidly grew less stagnant, an hour passed before she could make sufficient effort to crawl upstairs to bed. In her room, a further shock awaited her. The bloodless, drawn face reflected in the mirror was scarcely recognizable. The eyes lacked luster, the lips were white, the skin hung flabby on the shrunken flesh, giving it a look of premature old age. Tiny trickle of dry blood, the solitary smudge of color, stained the chalky pallor of her neck. Taking up a hand glass, she examined this with momentary concern. It was the old wound reopened, an angry-looking sore, almost like the bite of something small or very sharp-toothed animal. It smarted painfully. Mrs. Whatcombe, bursting into the breakfast room next morning with suggestions of an expedition to the neighboring town, was shocked at Irene's looks and insisted on going at once to fetch the doctor. Mrs. Whatcombe fussed continually during the interview and insisted on an examination of the scar upon Irene's neck. Patient and doctor had regarded this as a negligible detail, but finally the latter subjected it to a slightly puzzled scrutiny, advising that it should be kept bandaged. He suggested that Irene was suffering from anemia and would do well to keep as quiet as possible, building up her strength with food, open windows, and a general selection of pills and tonics. But despite these comforting arrangements, no one was entirely satisfied.
The doctor lacked something in assurance. Irene was certain that she could not really be anemic, while Mrs. Whatcom was obsessed by inward misgivings, perfectly indefinable, yet nonetheless disturbing. She left the house as a woman bent under a load of care. Passing up the lane, her glance lighted on the old sumac, more crimson now, more flourishing in its growth than she had seen it since the time of Geraldine's fatal illness. "I loathe that horrid old tree," she murmured, then added, struck by a nameless premonition. "Her husband ought to know. I shall wire to him at once." Irene, womanlike, put to use her enforced idleness by instituting a rearrangement of the box room, the only part of her new home which yet remained unexplored. Among the odds and ends of the rubbish to be thrown away, there was a little notebook, apparently unused. In idle curiosity, Irene picked it up, and was surprised to learn from an inscription that her cousin Geraldine had intended to use it as a diary. A date appeared, only a few days prior to the poor girl's death. But no entries had been made, although the first two pages of the book had certainly been removed. As Irene put it down, there fluttered to the ground a torn scrap of writing. She stooped and continued stooping, breathlessly staring at the words that had been written by her cousin's hand. "Sumac fascinates me in some unaccountable manner. This applied to her." It was obvious what tree was meant, the old sumac at the end of the lawn. And it fascinated her, Irene, though not until that moment had she openly recognized the fact. Searching hurriedly through the notebook, she discovered near the end a heap of torn paper, evidently the first two pages of a diary. She turned the pieces in eager haste. Most of them bore no more than one short word, or portions of a longer one, but a few bigger fragments proved more enlightening, and filled with nervous apprehension. She carried the book to her escritoire, and spent the remainder of the afternoon in trying to piece together the torn-up pages. Meanwhile, Mrs. Whatcom was worrying and fretting over Irene's unexpected illness, her pallor, her listlessness. Even the curious mark upon her neck gave cause for positive alarm. So exactly did they correspond with symptoms exhibited by her cousin Geraldine during the few days prior to her death. She wished that the village doctor who had attended the earlier case would return soon from his holiday, as his locum tenens seemed sadly wanting in that authoritative decision which is so consoling to patients, relatives, and friends. Feeling, as an old friend, responsible for the welfare of Irene, she wired to Hillary, telling him of the sudden illness and advising him to return without delay. The urgency of the telegram alarmed him, so much so that he left London by the next train, arriving at Cleeve Grange shortly after dark. "Where's your mistress?" was his first inquiry as the maid met him in the hall.
"Upstairs, sir. She complained of feeling tired and said she would go to bed."
He hurried to her room, only to find it empty. He called, he rang for the servants. In a moment the whole house was astir. Yet nowhere was Irene to be found. Deeming it possible that she might have gone to see Mrs. Whatcom, Hillary was about to follow when that lady herself was ushered in.
"I saw the lights of your cab," she commenced, cutting short the sentence as she met his questioning glance. "Where is Irene?"
"Irene? My dear Hillary, is she not here?"
"No, we can't find her anywhere. I thought she might have been with you."
For the space of half a second, Mrs. Whatcom's face presented a picture of astonishment. Then the expression changed to one of dismayed concern.
"She's in that tree. I'm certain of it. Hillary, we must fetch her in at once. Completely at a loss to understand, they followed the excited woman into the garden, stumbling blindly in her wake across the lawn. The darkness was intense, and a terrific wind beat them back as if with living hands. Irene's white dress at length became discernible, dimly thrown up against the pitchy background, and obscured in places by the twists and coils of the old sumac. Between them, they grasped the sleeping body, but the branches swung wildly in the gale, and to Hillary's confused imagination, it was as if they had literally to tear it from the tree's embrace. At last, they regained the shelter of the house and laid their inanimate burden upon the sofa. She was quite unconscious, pale as death, and her face painfully contorted as if with fear. The old wound on the neck, now bereft of bandages, had been reopened and was wet with blood. Hillary rushed off to fetch the doctor, while Mrs. Whatcom and the servants carried Irene to her room. Several hours passed before she recovered consciousness, and during that time Hillary was gently but firmly excluded from the sick room. Bewildered and disconsolate, he wandered restlessly about the house until his attention was arrested by the unusual array of torn-up bits of paper on Irene's desk. He saw that she had been sorting out the pieces and sticking them together as the sentences became complete. The work was barely half finished, yet what there was to read struck him as exceedingly strange. The seat in the old sumac fascinates me. I find myself going back to it unconsciously, nay, even against my will. Oh, but the nightmare visions it always brings me! In them I seem to plumb the very depths of terror. Their memory preys upon my mind, and every day my strength grows less. Dr. H. speaks of anemia. That was as far as Irene had proceeded. Hardly knowing why he did so, Hillary resolved to complete the task. But the chill of early morning was in the air before it was finished. Cramped and stiff, he was pushing back his chair when a footstep sounded in the doorway and Mrs. Whatcom entered. "Irene is better," she volunteered immediately. "She is sleeping naturally. And Dr. Thompson says there is no longer any immediate danger. The poor child is terribly weak and bloodless." "May, tell me, what is the meaning of all this? Why has Irene suddenly become so ill? I can't understand it." Mrs. Whatcom's face was preternaturally grave. "Even the doctor admits that he is puzzled," she answered very quietly. "The symptoms all point to a sudden and excessive loss of blood, though in cases of acute anemia." "God, but not like Geraldine. I can't believe it."
"Neither can I. Oh, Hillary, you may think me mad, but I can't help feeling that there is some unknown, some awful influence at work. Irene was perfectly well 3 days ago, and it was the same with Geraldine before she was taken ill. The cases are so exactly similar. Irene was trying to tell me something about a diary, but the poor girl was too exhausted to make herself properly understood."
"Diary? Geraldine's diary, do you think? She must mean that. I have just finished piecing it together, but frankly, I can't make head nor tail of it."
Mrs. Whatcom rapidly scanned the writing, then studied it again with greater care. Finally, she read the second part aloud.
"Listen, Hillary, this seems to me important. Dr. H. speaks of anemia. Pray heaven he may be correct, for my thoughts sometimes move in a direction which foreshadows nothing short of lunacy, or so people would tell me. If I could bring myself to confide these things, I must fight alone, clinging to the knowledge that it is usual for anemic persons to be obsessed by unhealthy fancies. If only I had not read those horribly suggestive words in Barrett. Barrett, what can she mean, May?
Wait a moment. Barrett.
Barrett's Traditions of the County, perhaps. I have noticed a copy in the library. Let us go there. It may give us the clue.
The book was quickly found, and a marker indicated the passage to which Geraldine apparently referred.
At Cleve, I was reminded of another of those traditions, so rapidly disappearing before the spread of education. It concerned the old beliefs in vampires, spirits of the evil dead, who by night could assume a human form and scour the countryside in search of victims. Suspected vampires, if caught, were buried with a mouth stuffed full of garlic and a stake plunged through the heart, whereby they were rendered harmless, or at least confined to that one particular locality. Some 30 years ago, an old man pointed out a tree which was said to have grown from such a stake. So far as I can recollect, it was an unusual variety of a sumac, and had been enclosed during a recent extension to the garden of the old grange.
"Come outside," said Mrs. Whatcombe, breaking a long and solemn silence. "I want you to see that tree." The sky was suffused with a blush of early dawn, and the shrubs, the flowers, even the dew upon the grass, caught and reflected something of the pink effulgence. The sumac alone stood out, dark and menacing. During the night its leaves had become a hideous mottled purple. Its growth was oily, bloated, unnaturally vigorous, like that of some rank and poisonous weed. Mrs. Whatcombe, looking from afar, spoke in frightened, husky tones.
"See, Hilary, it was exactly like that one when Geraldine died."
When evening fell, the end of the lawn was strangely bare. In place of the old tree, there lay an enormous heap of smoldering embers. Enormous, because the sumac had been too sodden with dark and sticky sap to burn without the assistance of large quantities of other timber. Many weeks elapsed before Irene was sufficiently recovered to walk as far as Spot's little grave. She was surprised to find it almost hidden in a bed of garlic. Hilary explained that it was the only plant they could induce to grow there. Join me next week for more tales of the unseen and the unknown on Stories from the Shadows. Until then, I wouldn't blame you if you leave the lights on.